Good evening. I'm at Soja, and I'd like to welcome you to a multi-layered lecture. I'll try to sort of very quickly and very briefly discuss the multiple layers. First of all, it is part of a Thursday evening lecture series that is co-sponsored by the Cities Program at London School of Economics and the Royal Academy of the Arts. And we thank the Royal Academy of Arts for their support for this lecture program. I am here in part representing the Cities Program. I'm a visiting professor here, as I have been for a number of autumn quarters. Another layer is that it is a third in a series of an extraordinary lecture series. The James Sterling Memorial Lecture on Cities, a prize that was begun in 2003, rooted and sponsored by the Canadian Centre for Architecture, the CCA, in Montreal, and the Cities Program at the London School of Economics, sponsoring a lecture designed to stimulate and encourage critical perspectives on the city and on urban design. And the very first winner of this award for creative and innovative thinking about urban design was Teddy Cruz, who will be speaking to you tonight. Another layer of this lecture is that we're following it up with a seminar that I do not want to encourage all of you to come, because it will take place in a relatively small room tomorrow at 9:30 in the morning. And this would be designed to sort of follow up and make some critical responses to this evening's lecture and to perhaps introduce some related kinds of discussion. If you are really interested, it's largely for doctoral students and graduate students around Los Angeles, but particularly those interested in urban affairs at LSE, there is a small flyer there to give you additional information. So I'd like to encourage those of you who are really interested to come tomorrow. I will go no further, because Teddy has a number of what I can tell you are absolutely wonderful visuals for you tonight. Just to provide another additional description and introduction, I will call on Phyllis Lambert from the CCA, the Canadian Centre of Architecture, Centre Canadien d'Architecture, who is the executive director of the centre. And I would also just like to congratulate and mention Mirko Zardoni in the audience, who has just recently been named the new director of the CCA, and he's here tonight as well. But Phyllis Lambert, please.
Hi, I'm very pleased to be here and see old friends and new friends, not old friends, and friends of long standing, I should say. And we're very pleased to be doing this, our project with the LSC. The CCA, just in case you are not too familiar with it, is a research center and a museum, and it was founded on the perspective that architecture is an urgent concern. And this conference, this prize, is in honor of James Sterling, of course, and who he believed that urban design was part of architecture, very strongly so. And as you know, cities have been changing tremendously in the last decade or so, more quickly than they have for a long time. And rather than go back to the people who gave the positions of kind of central things, London, Rome, whatever, and had positions from the 60s and 70s, we're much more interested in the younger people who are really addressing and really know the problems that are issue from, this is both LSE and CC, I'm not just talking about us. New assumptions about, or new positions about the urban environment. And Teddy Cruz, of course, with his conference tonight, is a splendid progenitor for the rest of the series. So I think that maybe, Teddy, you can take my place.
wish there was a little tequila to warm up the stomach and calm down the butterflies in the stomach. I would like to, of course, thank everyone who has been instrumental in making this happen. I think that it is really, I was thinking about it, there is no other program possibly out there that promotes, in 1 year, the evolution or the kind of elaboration of a series of ideas that are put on a table for discussion. I think the last year has been really amazing, beginning in Montreal last October, and then stopping in New York City, where there was a really wonderful seminar after the lecture as a way of responding to some of the issues that I was able to, to share with others. And then now here, the last station. So it's been a sort of a journey, not only across institutions, I think, but also across, of course, borders, across countries. And through that journey, the encounter of amazing people. And that, I think, ultimately is a legacy of this, of this program of the Stirling Memorial Lecture on the City. I would advise all of you who, to really apply for this. It's an amazing opportunity to be able to be supported in elaborating, again, one's own work, one's own sort of impressions. And these impressions have to do with, particularly with the territory where I live, even though, of course, I hope to suggest that by understanding the idiosyncrasies, the kind of particularities of the border territory where I live, we could anticipate also the kind of mutation of other cities, other conditions globally. So I would like to say right away that what I'm sharing with you tonight is really has emerged from a kind of visceral and at times very much emotional encounter with the very dramatic images that really have emerged in my life between San Diego and Tijuana, the place, again, where I live and work. But more specifically, again, without spending too much time, but, Phyllis Lambert, Mirko Sardini, Denise Bratton, who was incredibly instrumental for this to happen, Ed Soja. The jury who selected the paper was instrumental in also participating in the discussion. So it's not that competition where the jury just disappears after deliberating. They have been intimately, interacting, I think, with this idea. So this is fantastic. So thank you to all of you for supporting this. So I'll begin right away, and I'm trying to look for yes, here. Would this light be okay, or is it possible to lower the light so that the image is... I would like to begin by, for a moment, zooming out and away from the particularities of the region that I live in, and to begin to speculate for a moment in what would happen if we were to extend the border that divides Mexico, let's say, or Latin America from the U.S., and more specifically, the border between Tijuana and San Diego. If we were to extend it in a world atlas, what would occur? And what would emerge would be, in a certain way, a political equator that would coincide with the post-9/11 revision of the world's geography by the Pentagon's new map. This Pentagon's new map, sort of this renovated global border divides again the perpetual or sort of perennial division of hemispheres between the third and the first worlds, but now reconceptualized into what we can call the, or as they call it actually, the non-integrating gap and the functioning core. It is also coincidental as we travel through this political equator of sorts to speculate that it is in fact, this is a contested border, or global border, where some of the most dramatic socioeconomic dynamics are occurring as we speak in the world, in the shape of two-way cross-hemispheric crossings, in a sense. So we find that on one hand, the very dramatic influx of migration or the migration of people across this political equator, moving from the non-integrating gap, searching for the strong economies of the functioning core, is fundamentally shifting our notions of the territory. In a kind of reverse colonization of sorts, as this illegal, let's say, flow of people settle in North America and Europe, and in Europe. And in the opposite direction, we find that by the reorganization of the means of production, also there is a kind of southward sort of journey as we know, multinationals are searching, of course, for the cheap economies of the non-integrating gap in enacting this sort of politics of outsourcing. As we find also that this incredible influx, so this wave of immigration without precedent at this moment begins to settle in many European and American cities, North American cities, we begin to notice that this illegal, let's say, migration generates an amazing flow of capital that goes back to the non-integrating gap in a shape of informal subsidies. And by that I mean, let's say, in Mexico alone, the money that a lot of illegal immigrants in the U.S. send back to Mexico amounts to $10.5 billion. That makes that the second largest source of income, source domestic sort of revenue for Mexico after oil. So the impact, the sheer impact of these informal subsidies as they are sent back to the non-integrating gap to in fact contribute to the construction of official, let's say, development. And it is also interesting that along this very contested global border or political equator is where we found, where we find some of the most intensified critical thresholds around the world. One of them, of course, being the one, the place where I live, the Tijuana-San Diego border. But also we find the Gibraltar Strait, of course, where the most intensified sort of funnel of immigration from North Africa enters into Europe. And even touching on the Palestinian-Israeli border, the most, again, contested, not only emblematic, physical, but a border in the Middle East. And of course, it would be interesting now to really come down and really begin to elaborate on the particularities of one of those such critical thresholds, because by noticing or by observing the intensity, the kind of drama of the conditions that are really reshaping at this moment as we speak the border between Tijuana and San Diego, again, we could anticipate the mutation and the dynamics that will transform our notions of housing, of city, and of the territory worldwide. As you might know, the Tijuana-San Diego checkpoint, or the border between Tijuana and San Diego, is the most trafficked border in the world. 60 million crossings annually, 50,000 to 150,000 daily crossings by commuters who move from Tijuana into San Diego to work legally. And not to mention the amount of incredible amount of services and goods that really move through this intensified, again, funnel. And so it is very interesting, in a way, to notice that at this moment, as we speak, the intensity of this socioeconomic and cultural flow is being suppressed once more in the history of this border, as Homeland Security is pouring billions of dollars into the Tijuana, San Diego territory to increase its infrastructure of surveillance. So that the existing checkpoint at this moment will be fundamentally transformed in a very gigantic sort of intervention that not only is sort of refurbishing this existing checkpoint with more sort of military infrastructure, but it's really changing the whole ecology of the border itself across the Tijuana territory. It is ironic that at this moment, when we think of this most poignant post 9/11 intervention in the United States at this very, very place, that it could be the excuse for these two cities to collaborate in sort of constructing their own sort of future by sharing the infrastructure and by sharing really the conditions that really could promise this possibility. It's interesting to notice that when we erase for a moment the two cities, that these two border cities, and we only leave the political, the geopolitical boundary and the natural one, we see this very odd juxtaposition between the Tijuana River and the political, again, a border, as the Tijuana River enters into San Diego and finally ends into the Pacific Ocean. What is interesting is that the checkpoint is exactly at the intersection of those two border conditions. And of course, as we all know, Kevin Lynch prepared this sort of vision study for Tijuana and San Diego at one point in the 70s. He came to San Diego and suggested that Tijuana and San Diego could, in fact, take into account the amazing network of canyons that move from Alta to Baja California as a possible armature for development in anticipating, again, the future growth of these two cities. And not to mention, again, the endless amount of sort of natural ecologies that percolate or that move through these borders. So it's a very sad thing that at this very moment, when this checkpoint is fundamentally transformed, it just becomes a missed opportunity, the possibility that these two cities collaborate in sharing this condition. And instead, of course, Homeland Security, aided by its new sort of constitution, the Patriot Act, is only interested in the further barricading and the hardening of this wall that would distance Tijuana from San Diego again. So this series of situations that are occurring at this very moment, it would invite one to meditate on the chronology of the wall, When was the wall built? Already images of Alex Webb from the early 70s show Colonia Libertad in Tijuana, on the Tijuana side, on the Mexican side, crashing against San Diego, and then San Diego retreating, leaving this no man's land. But there is no wall. You see children flying kites, oblivious of the political boundary. We can speculate, you know, when was the first time when the first chain link fence was built, or the moment in the early 90s when, with the remnants from the temporal landing mats that were used in the Desert Storm War, this wall was built. So this is a true paramilitary shield built with this leftover infrastructure. And to the moment now when this wall is being replaced, because they found that this wall actually was incredibly inefficient. You know, the corrugation is horizontal, allowing people to climb, and it is completely, you know, hermetic and solid, so it allowed people to hide behind. So they had to hire, I guess, engineers to design a new wall that now is made of concrete pylons that are strategically separated to minimize human spillage and to maximize visuality. I call this the most, sort of the longest panopticon in history. And crowned, of course, by an electrified fence. And also, as this border moves to the Tijuana territory through miles, Homeland Security is carving this highway of surveillance that is destroying the ecology, again, between these two cities, disregarding every single environmental policy to date. So the intensification of this sort of infrastructure of surveillance and the kind of indifference to this sociocultural and economic flow, this increasing of the militarization at the edge, also makes me think how these attitudes are not only site-specific, that they begin to permeate the rest of the territory. I will never forget this image in the mid-90s in San Diego, when a common citizen, let's say, went out to look for his nearest military base in San Diego to steal a tank in order to drive it back to his master plan community, which in a way radicalizes this sort of mixture. It's a very strange alliance between militarization and urbanization packaged into this lifestyle, in a sense, an attitude that ultimately is enacted and manifested in this solid wall that transforms San Diego into the world's largest gated community. So what I'm trying to suggest is that as the wall has hardened in the last 30 years, in tandem with that, it has been also the hardening of a social legislature and a kind of cultural policy towards space, towards urbanism, in the rest of the territory. Enacting or perpetuating this idea of planning as a kind of discriminating policy that is still very much built on the issue of separation, exclusion, as these conditions of, again, inclusion and separation really are very much shaping this territory. Infrastructures of surveillance, a kind of urbanism of fear, as Mike Davis has pointed out, the further and incremental barricading of public space, of public infrastructure and institution, of natural ecologies, and the separation and division of community continue to be very much the basis of this idea. But what makes this alliance between systems of control, in a way, and development, which is nothing new, of course, to the history of urbanism, what makes this alliance incredibly dramatic in our time, I think, is its further alliance with the increasing neoliberalist economic policies across the world of homogenization and privatization. These strange notions, at least in the US at this moment, of ownership society, you know, supported by the economic policies of private economic expansion, promise also to engender divisive tensions across communities in terms of social and economic inequalities, and of course the erosion of public institutions across nation states, across hemispheres. I mean, it's something that I thought was only unique to the United States, but I see it also increasingly occurring here in Europe as well. And as Saskia Sassen has pointed out, when this sort of new global economy, let's say this notion, today I was talking about it with a friend, this notion of the globalization of nothing. I mean, this notion, this very abstract notion of this new global economy, when it hits the actual reality of the territory, when it hits the ground, it divides into two projects. One, the mega project of redevelopment, the mega project of glamour, as Saskia called it, and on the other hand, the project of marginalization, that for each of those projects of mega redevelopment, there is we need, of course, the service sector, the service community that will support that. Suggesting, of course, that ultimately the border is not only a kind of geopolitical or cultural. I mean, it's ultimately a geoeconomic, of course, border that continues in primarily in our time, dividing the world between those societies of over excess and production and those societies of need and scarcity. And of course, locally for each urbanism, for each defensible urbanism, or for each urbanism of control, there is built into it, I think, an urbanism of transgression, of encroachment, of micro-utopias, as I could call them, existing and emerging in this border territory that have fundamentally changed my role as an architect, as I witness the kind of cultural production that has emerged here in the last decades. This is the border, the fence, of course, that divide Tijuana and San Diego, but in the larger, sort of broader sense, Latin America from the United States. Many times, when I'm in front of this fence, exactly at this point, I meditate, this is the place where the whole continent of Latin America ends, at least geopolitically, because we know that through those gaps, there is an amazing flow of influence that has begun to completely transform the nature of the American metropolis. I'm talking about the influence of immigration and the reshaping of the physical, you know, conditions of many of our cities. At this very moment, when the border finally sinks into the Pacific Ocean after traversing the Tijuana landscape for miles, it creates this very strange sight of both poetry, but of course of tragedy. It is this sense of contradiction and ambiguity what really defines this border territory. I'm interested in the conditions, not only of observing these conditions of difference, but also this possibility of juxtaposition as in a series of south to north, north to south double journeys, similar to that notion of the kind of cross-hemispheric crossings here as well, in a more localized condition, we find this same sort of transference. I will never forget when a friend of mine, R, an artist from Tijuana, stationed temporarily in the middle of traffic, crossing from Tijuana into San Diego, this gigantic double-headed Trojan horse as part of this binational art project. He got permission to do it, to station this horse right on the border. In between the two wheels, you find the plaque of the border. So two wheels are in Mexico, two wheels are in the United States, the horse impossibly occupying both places in the midst of these dialectic forces. As he called it, this is my temporal home, a kind of notion of identity that is less built with out of stylistic sort of recipes or packaging of identity, but more in the vicissitudes of the journey, he said. It is two-headed because the flow is not anymore unilateral from south to north, but also from north to south. For me, it was an amazing moment because I realized, of course, that while we architects continue only inhabiting the official space delimited by property lines to insert our manicure sort of project of architecture, the artist continues to occupy the least expected place, appropriating the materials, let's say, of the cities in an act of sort of criticism. So when I saw this horse emerging unnoticeably from one day to another in the middle of traffic, I thought that it would be the most emblematic image of contemporary urbanism. So that's just like the Trojan horse could station itself anywhere in the city to deploy strategies of transgression and appropriation. In other words, an urbanism beyond the property line, a series of tactics of encroachment that could really redefine the relationship between the private and the public. Another moment in this sort of series of anti-monuments and monuments that have emerged from one day to another. Years ago, I discovered La Mona, as many of us who live in this region, as Armando Muñoz, somebody who Michel Desertot could have definitely called a common hero, decided to build an homage to his own city of Tijuana in its 100th anniversary in 1989. He decided to build this Statue of Liberty for not only his neighborhood, but also for his city. In fact, he said, this is to suggest that the future of Tijuana depends on the political power of its women. But while he was presenting this gift to the city, he also was using it as his house addition. So it's really, it's inhabitable. He lived inside the statue. This condition, again, that cities like Tijuana continue to really be built out of very spontaneous gestures that emerge from one day to another again, the kind of expression of the struggles, the kind of subjective and collective struggles of its inhabitants, is something that would allow me to say that, you know, situation is thinking in a way, is manifested ultimately in these kinds of environments when anybody, in this case Armando Muñoz, could appropriate the materials of its own city to convey a message, to construct a more radical, let's say, urbanism of encroachment. from north to south, we find increasingly the transference of materials and systems from San Diego into Tijuana, as to suggest that, in fact, Tijuana, in many ways, builds itself with the waste of San Diego, with the waste of the other. So we find a developer from Tijuana, let's say, going to San Diego to buy houses that are going to be demolished, because a developer might build a larger condominium project, let's say. This person, this developer, brings these houses on wheels and stations them temporarily next to the border while he gets permission to cross them into Tijuana. So entire houses cross the border, not only people. And once they are in Tijuana, the houses are put on top of these steel frames, leaving a space of ambiguity below that will be infilled through time with other houses, other programs, other uses. So this sort of temporal conditions of urbanism, the temporality of this evolutionary, let's say, programmatic intensification is something that is very much a lesson for all of us who live in this border region. And of course, it has also become a style in Tijuana. So this house, in fact, was not recycled from San Diego to Tijuana, but it was built from scratch in Tijuana when a person decided to build, to approximate his two most precious dreams, to build a pink track home from, you know, similar to the ones that you find in San Diego, but also to accommodate his car repair shop. So this sort of approximation of opposites, again, is what really constructs a very different idea of urbanism, but also the kind of vertical layering of programs. Of course, from south to north, we have the sheer pressure of people pushing against this dam that would prevent the chaotic, seemingly chaotic density of Tijuana from contaminating the picturesque periphery of San Diego. Again, the influence or the effect that immigration has incrementally been exerting on a lot of these neighborhoods, so that when immigrants cross the border and they settle in many San Diego neighborhoods or Los Angeles or San Francisco or Chicago, let's say, they begin to generate non-conforming patterns of development, non-conforming, as I say non-conforming because that's how the building department, the planning department calls them in San Diego, illegal patterns of density, of mixed uses, this insurgent, more flexible urbanism. Probably, there is no other place in the world where some of the wealthiest subdivisions are closest, are only 20 minutes away from some of the poorest settlements in Latin America. As we begin to notice these sort of two cities approximating each other, but built with very different attitudes towards the territory. These two ways of constructing, let's say, the city, are we can witness in this at this very juncture. On one hand, we could say that the periphery of San Diego is really emblematic of, again, a kind of planning attitude of segregation as manifested in the gated communities, master plan communities that dot the periphery of San Diego, as again, private bulldozers continue to flatten the topography of the edges of San Diego, the relationship between civic identity and the land and the territory is reenacted. We begin to notice that the most emblematic maybe image of identity is a fingerprint, but also analogous of a topographic condition. We could speculate in a way that topography is identity, since there are no two topographic conditions that are the same. And if we flatten topography, then we are flattening, of course, difference. We are flattening political will, and this is what is really happening in the edges of many American cities, again, as private developers are flattening the territory in order to install on it the very cheap recipes, again, of these master plan communities. Emerging from this, of course, a kind of beige architecture, as I call it, or this sort of urbanism of sameness. 20 minutes away from here, we find that the periphery of Tijuana itself is shaped by a very completely different attitude, of course. While in San Diego, emerges out of an urbanism of distance, separation, and of course, in Tijuana's periphery is shaped by an informal urbanism that depends on distance mitigation, on the negotiation, in fact, of boundaries and resources of the territory itself, as people in a kind of social emergency have to build these environments in order to survive. But it's a very different attitude, of course, in relationship to the territory itself, constructed, in fact, again, with a multiplicity of systems that are imported from San Diego. Tijuana, for example, is the world's possibly largest importer of tires, as people bring all this waste and begin to, in a very clever and inventive ways, create very fragile and small infrastructures, as these retaining walls that are made out of tires. But as we as architects are again seduced and very much excited about this sort of return to the informal, people themselves continue to improve the system so that these objects are so seemingly are inert for us, are transformed and dismantled in order to create more operative, more operational, sort of more efficient systems. So I found this wall the other day, and I found that people had already found a way of peeling off the tire, folding it inside out, and loop it in this sort of eight shape and interlock it to create a more solid, more stable retaining wall. Of course, we find pallet racks, windows, constructing inhabitation, garage doors. You know, many times driving in the freeways of San Diego, you would find a truck full of garage doors moving, you know, from that city to Tijuana. So it is this sort of differential architecture made of contingency, but of course, out of this sort of condition of emergency that shapes a completely different sense of sprawl in Tijuana. Of course, it would be silly to just concentrate on these conditions of difference. For me, it's important to convey that this territory is very much still constructed out of contrast and difference. Some of the most amazing dramatic images really are about juxtaposition, how these two cities unavoidably contain each other already. So we find in San Diego neighborhoods, of course, again, some of the informal patterns of density and mixed use from Tijuana. And of course, in Tijuana, we find some of the sort of mini projects of glamour, right? So these mini malls equipped with all its franchises appearing in the Tijuana streets. So of course, the import and exports of symbols of progress continue to define really the way that our cities are developing. Who was going to imagine, actually Ed, coming from California, who was going to imagine that the urban code of Southern California was going to shape the periphery almost single-handedly of almost every city in the world, as this is what people really are building everywhere. Even in China, as we recently have found these very dramatic images, as this development called, in fact, Orange County, China, a Chinese developer imported, faithfully reproduced this master plan community from Orange County, using every single material from the cheap plastic stucco to the cheap aluminum windows to create this resort for the nouveau riche outside Beijing. But this is in fact what is being built in the periphery of Tijuana itself. As Tijuana, seduced by the glamour of these sort of master plan gated communities, begins to build its new social housing around its periphery, thousands of little boxes permeating the Tijuana territory, equally flattening its topography, as developers install this sort of recipe aided by federal subsidies now. It's a completely unprecedented condition in Mexico and many Latin American countries. And we find these, what I call mini-me's, which are these mini master plan gated communities, unfortunately built out of concrete, in fact. So we have mini front yards, mini setbacks, mini backyards, 250 square feet houses, two bedrooms. And of course, even though this is built out of these very sort of literal recipes of developers from San Diego into Tijuana, the lack of restrictions in terms of regulation allows people, in fact, already encroach into the front yard, creating this little shop, or maybe two houses down, we find a second floor. In 10 years, this environment will be completely transformed. And this is very interesting because as developers continue to kind of send this image that it is a style and it is sort of the way these buildings look, what really is selling, it's obvious that this is ultimately putting to rest this debate in a way that what people are looking here is not a pretty facade, but possibly the opportunities of these infrastructures to be flexible enough to provide a kind of mobility, let's say, as these people expand and as they inhabit out of their own, again, idiosyncrasies, and the need to construct alternative economies in their own environments. So it is these sort of dynamics and these patterns that have really been of interest to all of us, I think. Finally, these issues, these sociopolitical and cultural conditions are back to the table in terms of our own fields. And I have been preoccupied, of course, with this particular region, as in the last years, I've been bringing students of architecture and urbanism from all over Latin America, in fact, to Los Angeles. I taught for 8 years this workshop at SciArc called LA, Latin America, Los Angeles, and we built hundreds of these very large images that were constructed out of fragments, out of pieces of infrastructure, wasted spaces, dormant sort of, you know, vacant parcels to construct these larger landscapes, suggesting or anticipating or what is really preoccupying a lot of us at this moment, challenging the kind of one-dimensionality and autonomy of the object in the city, let's say the architectural object, instead embracing the kind of multiplicity, again, of social, political, and economic forces that construct city. The images were inspired, in a way, by the words of Walter Benjamin, who once said that a critical reading of a city could emerge out of recombining its pieces of reality. So the encountering, again, of the reality of that social territory and the understanding that the city is less a static repository of objects and more, again, a kind of force field that whose cross-section is very complex. So all of us are interested in returning to the city, I think, from artistic practices to architects and urbanists. But as we return to the city to reenact it in a way as a laboratory, as a kind of experimental laboratory, we seem to continue perpetuating the return either to the center or the periphery, so that the debate continues to be centered into this sort of center-periphery kind of binary or dichotomy. As we return to the center with a mega project of redevelopment, usually accompanied by stadia or sports facilities and high-end loft housing, this is really the pattern all over the United States, in this sort of very large project of gentrification, or to the very expensive now periphery made of these mad mansions all over, again, the edges of the United States, the territory that we continue to ignore is a space in between, the middle landscape, the mid-city, the inner city, in fact, the first ring of suburbanization in many of our cities around the world. It's interesting or coincidental that it is this the territory where many of these Asian, African, or even Latin American diasporas are settling. It is here with most of these immigrants and this sort of what become the service sector of the service communities that support the mega project of redevelopment of downtown or the very expensive sort of master plan communities of the periphery. So we could speculate by noticing or observing these patterns in the last 40 years of how this first ring of suburbanization after the war in this sort of Levittown kind of patterns that might have looked like this, of course, in many of the neighborhoods outside downtown San Diego, in the last 30 years, this one-dimensionality of this sort of landscape has begun to transform out of the very temporal dynamics, the kind of social dynamics as non-conforming, again, uses and patterns of development begin to completely transform the condition of these environments. I found the other day this, what I call a non-conforming Buddha, because it actually encroaches into the setback. So we could speculate, again, by noticing or observing the effect of this transformation that for a lot of us is very difficult to map and to understand, by actually noticing the effect of this social and kind of temporal dynamics and how they have transformed the one-dimensionality of these neighborhoods, we could, in fact, speculate that in the next 50 years or 60 years, the second, third, fourth, or fifth ring of suburbanization will be also transformed, let's say, so that the mad mansions being built in the edges of San Diego will have to be retrofitted to accommodate difference in a kind of a scale of a kind of additive, let's say, transformation or evolutionary kind of transformation. What this points out is that we continue to ignore, again, the nature and the kind of power of these forces. So even our institutions of representation, particularly from the city, the forms of governance, are unable to really acknowledge the impact of these forces. So we continue to represent land use maps in some of these neighborhoods with this image of red as retail and yellow as residential. Well, I took a group of students, in fact, to this neighborhood to really build up the evidence that this is really lying, in a sense, that this is not a truthful representation of this land use. And we found that there were probably 40 or, you know, 30 more colors, and they were not adjacent to each other, but really on top of each other, as people negotiating their own boundaries, private property, parcels, etc. Equally, private development is unable, of course, to really cope or to really understand or absorb the nature of these forces. And private developers who are, in fact, in the United States at this moment building some of the most housing, let's say, are really co-opting, in this case, new urbanist ideas or smart growth ideas just to hide behind it the true problems of the city and instead building or enacting this sort of fake facade of difference. Even though these projects are, you know, dense and mixed use, they begin to look the same all over our cities. In a way, new urbanism, and again, co-opting politicians and developers, are really focusing on a project that really only has to do with beautification as they begin to enter the dynamics of these neighborhoods, instead of really looking, of course, at the true problems of the city ultimately are really having to do with the broken gaps, the gap between freeway and community, large infrastructure and a small sort of insurgent urbanism that is made of illegal, again, non-conforming patterns of density and use, and the encroachment of many of these communities into the public realm to construct alternative, let's say, economies. And of course, the recuperation of ecological networks of brownfields. I mean, some of these, the kind of politics of development and the economics of development really ultimately are ignored by many of these institutions of representation. Again, suggesting that we are continue to perpetuate this tension or this crisis, let's say, of representation, caught between style and process, as we continue again to ignore the actual sort of forms of governance that are inscripted in the territory, that we architects have not participated of the politics of the territory, of the actual boundaries that are enacted before we can even come and insert our own, again, project of beautification. Or the notion that the future of our cities, of course, out of understanding these many patterns, depends on the triangulation of density, housing, social, and ecological networks. So in the United States, at least, the future of housing is less in the hands of the government at this moment. Does not care at all about the kind of social program towards the city or a public institution, nor in the hands of private developers, which I could say, you know, I have a lot of really good friends in San Diego who are doing incredible work as developers, but generally speaking, in the United States, developers continue to operate under the credo of, you know, minimum investment, maximum profit, and really afraid of encroaching into the public realm. The future of housing in the United States is in the hands of NGOs, of community-based, socially-based organizations in many of these communities. It is, in fact, then this condition of trying to understand the impact of these forces, sociopolitically and culturally and economically, and how they can help one to construct an alternative practice within these geographies of conflict, what really has motivated me in the last years, as my practice straddles between, again, understanding the strategies of informal in Tijuana and the politics of zoning in San Diego. What can be learned from these conditions? I'm primarily committed to the contamination of zoning, let's say, in San Diego, or entering the politics of development and the economics of development in San Diego, understanding or learning from some of these NGOs or community-based nonprofit organizations that have been operating within these communities where some of these transformations have taken place in the last years, because they are the only ones that can make sense of mediating between the identities and histories of those communities and the policies that could shape their future in a very different way. So the notion that an NGO can be a mediating agency between policy and development has been an incredible lesson. Of course, it is these nonprofits that really are able to, again, make sense of this sort of informal urbanism or these patterns of development, suggesting that it is, of course, policy, the site of intervention, of contamination, of alteration of these sort of rigid patterns, let's say, of development. Also, the organizational practices of some of these nonprofit organizations, in the way that at this very moment when subsidies for housing are being very limited in the United States, they have to invent incredibly creative processes to find hidden resources, economically, of course, culturally, socially. So this sort of network of mobility of a nonprofit in order to make sense of a kind of social and political agenda that ultimately could be framed by an architecture. That has been a very spatial practice, has been a very interest. So Casa Familiar is a nonprofit that I've been primarily collaborating in the last 4 or 5 years, learning from the fact that this social service agency has now transformed into development. They are really committed to being the developers of very alternative housing projects for these communities. The main site besides of intervention, besides being policy, is ultimately information itself, the definitions and the language that really we have in a way exhausted. What is density ultimately? What is housing in the context of these forces? So we have devised workshops that are very interesting as sites of actual experimentation. So we devised at one point this game where we brought a block made of parcels, we brought wood blocks, and we brought trees and cars, and we asked the community or these people in this neighborhood, the real people who live, of course, in this neighborhood, to construct a kind of recipe of density, 14 units in cars and trees, and everybody froze. You know, nobody could move until this lady actually, you know, moved first, and what she did was ask, you know, who are my neighbors? You know, how are we able to really reconceptualize in a way the relationship of parcels to blocks? And she actually took one piece of wood and put it in one parcel, another piece of wood, put it in another parcel, and very soon she reproduced her own reality. This is exactly her block of individual buildings. And as we began to kind of suggest, you know, what would happen if we move them in this way and we can come into a zero setback condition, she began to kind of, get very excited about understanding this sort of notion of flexibility or of transferring or transgressing her own property lines. And at one point she said, this reminds me, I know she said actually in Spanish, Nunca pensé que estas casas eran egoístas. I never thought that these houses were selfish. The house, you know, the actual houses in her neighborhood. She said, this reminds me of my neighborhood in Guadalajara, where in fact I'm beginning to recollect the whole block was not made of individual buildings, but of a network of spaces. I mean, that's what she, in a way, in her home, her sort of interpretation. So the idea is that ultimately, the site of intervention is a demystification, in a sense, of a lot of these notions, and not to, again, benefit a very traditional approach, in this case, a kind of new urbanist agenda that has to do with formal form and style or beautification, but really the construction of that block. Who owns the block, and how are we are able to negotiate the kind of transaction across its borders. So that ultimately, of course, density is complexity, is levels of proximity and of social contingency. Out of these, of course, emerged a series of propositions for the city of San Diego. We realized through the nonprofit organization that before we could actually design a housing project, as we were commissioned to do two affordable housing projects for this community, before we could really design them, we had to advance a policy that we call in this case a kind of micro policy, so that again, sending a message to the forms of to the institutions of governance in San Diego that no advances in design could be made without advances in policy. So that the proposition for the city was that in this neighborhood of San Isidro, the nonprofit could become a facilitator with the community centered in the middle of that historic neighborhood of San Isidro before the freeway enters into Tijuana. It's less than a mile away from the border. Out of these workshops during the last 4 years with this community, we proposed to the city, out of this triangulation between architectural practice, let's say community and nonprofit, we proposed to the city to allow an affordable housing overlay zone, which is called an AHOS, that would allow us to actually measure and investigate the patterns of transformation in the last 30 years, to identify all the non-conforming patterns, the decrepit additions that people had improvised in the backyards of their homes. And furthermore, we invited the city to become a partner in this effort so that the city agreed to allow this affordable housing overlay zone, and also the city would have to legitimize, let's say, these non-conforming patterns. The additions that usually happen in the back of houses to hide them were in relationship to a series of alleys, a network of alleys that were already serving as pedestrian and landscape corridors in this community. So it was this relationship between mobility, circulation, and the actual forces of these patterns that really began to construct this policy. So that the nonprofit organization took the shape of a temporal city hall, in a way. So the property owner in this community, let's say Maria Perez, who lives two blocks away from the nonprofit, didn't have to go to the center of the city, people barely speak English, to negotiate an entitlement or a permit for this new building or this replacing of her little unit, now that the city would really legitimize it. So she would come, or he would come to the NGO would have already drawings that were entitled by the planning department in San Diego, allowing the replacement of this illegal unit now into a new unit. And at the same time, the nonprofit would also become the mediator between loans, between the banking, let's say, financial structures and the community itself. So the nonprofit proposed to a couple of banks in San Diego to break the recipe of this larger affordable housing project that depends on a very large pro forma in order to really allow these developers to make some profit. Said, how can we break it apart into smaller micro loans so that these informal additions can be supported or can be called affordable housing? So out of this political and economic, let's say, microstructure, micro policy, then we could propose a couple of projects that really would have a particular logic. The first one is living rooms at the border, which is in one of the parcels that the nonprofit organization purchased recently. 14,000 square feet. The parcel contains an existing 1927 church. And what we proposed in the beginning, from the beginning, was to acknowledge the kind of porosity of circulation across private property lines. As we begin to notice that people really move through these parcels. And we began to think of the parcel itself as a system of very ambiguous spaces that would have services, electricity, that would have a sort of community programs, so that the whole parcel was taken advantage of in order to generate a series of frames, let's say, that would accommodate some of these non-conforming informal economies and densities. So the idea that the site becomes became a kind of site for anticipating encounters. It's something that really has been essential to these projects. It's a kind of framework to facilitate interaction in the community. So for example, on a Saturday morning, one of these frames would become the site for a market, let's say, to support some of these, again, non-conforming economies. Or a Thursday night, as a non-profit organization is accustomed to do, there is social advising a month with workshops with the community. So the idea is that the church and these frames or these very ambiguous spaces would serve as sites for these kinds of programs. Or a Sunday, whole Sunday morning, a family could lease the whole site for, let's say, Sweet 16 party, you know, as the Mexican community really is accustomed to celebrate. So again, the idea that the whole site and the church would advance a very different idea towards what housing is through a kind of conceptual sort of layered process. The first was a creation of a community garden that would be the site for these encounters or these relationships, demarcating some kind of the possible, let's say, places that could be appropriated by the community. These are very sort of early diagrams of that. The second layer is the extrusion of this series of frames that are open-ended, again, that are very ambiguous, that contain services such as electricity, so that this also becomes the kind of stage for these interactions. We call them living rooms at the border, and that, of course, again, choreograph this really series of encounters. And the final layer is the housing itself that is stitched above and through this frame. The idea that these are frames or infrastructures for ambiguity, this is something that really became a lesson for this project. And this sort of layered, again, scheme, as you imagine, funding comes in layers to a nonprofit, so we had to devise a project that also performed in layers, from the garden to the rooms, to the kitchen and bathroom units, and the larger envelope that became the housing itself, so that even the envelope became flexible enough so that a two-bedroom unit could transform into an actual two one-bedroom units by sharing the kitchen, which is already a pattern that occurs in this community. And the idea that this very small project could become so political as to suggest to the city that they had to change their regulation became really ultimately the sort of legacy of this. This is what we presented to the planning director of San Diego in a kind of humorous, ironic board. We said at this moment, zoning only allows 3 units in this 14,000 square feet parcel, which is the Guatemalan General over there, 3 official units. And in turn, as we presented this project to the planning department, we said, you know, can we negotiate a density bonus because we are proposing this new sort of pedestrian activity, circulation networks, etc. They gave us 2 extra density units that became our Jimmy Carter units as we were talking to the planning director. And of course, these units were further designed so that they were flexible enough, which became the Comandante Marcos units, the kind of illegal units by sharing the kitchens. The message to the city in the end became, while the city allows only 3 units, we were proposing 12 units of housing, a market, a mercado, a community garden, a community center, and the offices of the nonprofit organization in the attic of this new, the renovated church. So 5 or 6 different uses supporting each other. Again, conveying to everyone in San Diego that when we talk about sustainability, beyond technological advances or technological sort of infrastructures, we had to speak of social sustainability. That density, again, needed to be spoken of in the context of social contingency, but also housing had to really be conceptualized beyond just being an amount of units, which is really our recipe for density. And instead, a relationship with other things, right, with other conditions, infrastructure, landscape, and of course, sociocultural patterns or idiosyncrasies. And the final challenge was, how do we make sense of this ambiguity? How can we pay for that framework, right, those rooms with electricity? Because they, of course, would go outside the recipe of the proforma. So we thought of calling them public art. So the whole frame that supports the housing with electricity will be funded, of course, by private, in a way, foundations, which we already have committed some funding for that, and the Commission for Arts and Culture of San Diego will also contribute to the construction of these frameworks so that now the more conventional affordable housing can be built on top. So this pairing, has become the legacy of this project, as small as it can be, of the specificity of the program that we need to address, but also the creation of this surplus space, this sort of ambiguity, these infrastructures of ambiguity that can support unexpected, let's say, encounters, unexpected social, again, programmatic mobility. How to inject ambiguity into the zoning regulation, how to inject ambiguity into the developer's performance, and how to inject ambiguity into the banking loans is a really part of the dilemma here, when all of these structures need the kind of specificity of a number, right? And they really would ignore the possibilities of framing these temporal dynamics. A couple of blocks away, we find a second project, which is a senior housing project that emerged from a very particular interaction with the seniors of this community as they began to tell us that a lot of them had the custody of their own grandchildren. So that this affordable housing project, the senior housing project, was thought of in the context of this childcare unit. Also, the seniors told us about this notion that in their very small apartments, the most promiscuous of objects was their table, that was the site for many different conditions. So again, how to frame again the kind of spatial promiscuity that could generate this series of unexpected patterns was an interesting thing to explore. How to march beyond this cookie cutter, development that we find in the periphery of San Diego and create this quilt, this social quilt of, again, made of very complex social relations was still the challenge. So in the second parcel, we thought of this sort of threading of a series of boundaries between private, again, and public use, a series of public linear gardens stitched with semi-public and public uses from which, again, an infrastructure, a very small infrastructure of kitchens and bathrooms that had to really be conceptualized as repetitive in order to respect the logic of the economy of these affordable projects, but at the same time wrapped with these sort of housing elements that would provide a sense of diversity. And in the end, a layer of very small infrastructures that really stitch themselves through these housing units as fences, as porches, as property walls became other things. The fences in some of these units or the porches became sites for the seniors, in fact, to sell food to the community as they do. So the whole recycling and the whole kind of reconceptualization of the most static and the smallest of pieces was very important here. So 14 units of housing we produced with peers by these semi-public space that the community could utilize again, and at the edge of the project, a childcare unit. So the whole project became again very much driven by this notion of this framework, this ambiguous framework between roofs and ground, where many things could occur. As we began to even locate the most insignificant programmatic elements as kitchens, and the kitchens were positioned along that an interior promenade, so that when the fences of these units were closed, the kitchens were private, but when they were open, they were stitching this collective social space so that the seniors could interact with each other. Again, this constant transaction between boundaries, again, blurring private and public uses. The alternation of the roofs were generated by two programmatic elements that we included, two extra units that were illegal in a certain way, one facing the alleys, that was conceived less as a granny flat, but instead as a grand, sort of a prodigal son flat, as these children came to see their own children, on one hand, and on the other, in the interior part of the promenade, a little flat for assistance for the seniors. This is the interior promenade, and as the alternating roofs marched towards the driveway, it became again a site for a very ambiguous, again, sort of space that allowed the absorbing the dynamics of the alleys as these informal patterns enter the project. And a message that we sent to the city was that for each of these affordable housing projects, the city would have to maintain a very small pocket public garden in the context of the childcare unit and the units themselves. So this constant collaboration between city and community is something that really became, again, the pattern. And 20 minutes away from San Isidro, we proposed a project to also intervene in Tijuana, because as you can imagine, living in a place where from one city to another, you can travel in 20 minutes, while our practice is very much interested in the kind of alteration of the rigidity of zoning in San Diego. In Tijuana, it's completely the opposite, because Tijuana already thrives with this sort of some of these sort of very complex social relations. So we wanted to insert some of these notions into the problematic of the slums. So we proposed a project by having the nonprofit organization as our partner to enter the kind of complexity of these sites. As Mike Davis has pointed out, 2 billion people live in slums around the world. The future, let's say, of the struggles of urbanism will be really enacted in some of those environments. And so how to really enter the dynamics of these slums has been very interesting, again, having Tijuana so close. So we began to notice how these settlements occur or emerge from one day to another as people invade land en masse, usually driven by what is called an urban pirate. Armed with cellular phones, they begin to choreograph the deployment of resources and of people in some vacant city lands around Tijuana. And this is a pattern that would occur all over, I think, the third world. But in Tijuana or in Mexico, particularly, it's very important because once people invade this land, they can really stay there. They cannot be forced out. They are called parachuters or paracaidistas, as they begin to appropriate or land illegally in some of these lands, some of these vacant properties, and through time, they begin, of course, to build their own inhabitation. As the city discovers these settlements, then the city begins to send services incrementally. Again, what we forget is that what precedes what is seemingly a kind of site of poverty and precariousness, what precedes that is a very sophisticated social organization with these people, as they not only inhabit the land, but ultimately ask for resources to the city. So water is sent, in the most dramatic of cases, the city sends one official line of electricity, expecting the community to steal the rest. So there are, you know, these clip-ons that are called little devils, as community members really risk their lives and really clip into this in order to have electricity. And of course, they begin to shape an infrastructure of circulation, etc. So this is the politics of the informal, I think, have come back to the conversation. I'll never forget when Lula in Brazil gave property titles to some of the slum dwellers in Rio de Janeiro or Sao Paulo, sending waves throughout, you know, the world. I mean, how to really insert these dynamics into the official sort of economic systems is a question that remains in my mind. So what we thought was, in order to first, you know, in order to enter the problem from a city in Tijuana, would have to be preceded equally as in the San Isidro case in San Diego, by a mini policy or a kind of proposition about collaboration between institutions and across jurisdictions. So the nonprofit organization in San Diego could channel funding that could support the municipality in San Diego to create speculative projects and a collaboration that would force eventually the CEOs of the maquiladoras who settled in Tijuana. I'm talking about, as you know, maquiladoras are sort of these factories, assembly factories that take advantage of the cheap labor in these parts of the world. In fact, the maquiladoras themselves settle in areas where it makes it easy for them to draw cheap labor from these communities without giving anything back to them. So the proposition was, how can we press these maquiladora CEOs to produce the most minimal gesture for maximum effect? In other words, a very small infrastructure that could insert or inject itself into the precariousness of this territory. So we, with the technologies of these maquiladoras, we propose this frame that could be sent, you know, these are like, instead of one house, we were sending 30 houses at one point and distributed to these families at the moment of invasion or post-occupation in a way. This frame, again, is very diagrammatic, but the idea was that it would serve as a kind of hinge that could mediate across a variety of uses and also across a variety of systems that the people in these neighborhoods or these communities take advantage of. In other words, all the recycling that occurs. So we did not want to compromise the improvisational practices that these people really invent in order to construct their own environments. So this hinge was to be injected into these precarious retaining walls, and to also, it would be accompanied by a catalog that would, similar to that retaining wall that was threaded with a very clever system of interweavings, that could also further instruct some of these people how to possibly weave garage doors or pallet racks. So the idea was, again, how to construct a very different set of relations that could support the kind of informal patterns. They could serve also the support for some of these houses that are imported from San Diego. ultimately, the idea was that this become, the other day when I was looking at these images, I thought this seems like a kind of portable new Babylon in a way. I mean, this scaffold that would incrementally grow out of constant sort of negotiation across these people, across this social organization, and also, of course, the recycling of resources. So the idea, again, was that we would be exploring or talking. I mean, a lot of these projects ultimately are only excuses to really send out a message to some of these particular communities about what housing really means in this context. In this particular neighborhood, housing, of course, was not really made of objects necessarily, but really was made of these constant transactions and negotiations with themselves as a community. I was lucky that during the course of the last year, as the Stirling Lecture evolved, I received a commission in San Diego to begin to set in motion some of these dynamics. I would like to add that the two projects that I showed you of San Isidro were accepted by the city of San Diego in January of this year as pilot projects that could advance, you know, notions of density and mixed use in some of these communities. So they are going to be built in the next 3 years with the city as partner. But in terms of this sort of transference of material from San Diego to Tijuana, I was lucky actually to get this commission, which is an information pavilion for a binational transborder art project that allowed me to propose to the curator of the exhibition the creation of a house that could be transferred to Tijuana and documented so that people in San Diego would be made aware of the recycling energies between these two cities. So we proposed to build a pavilion with the help of these two ready-made trucks that are in the market, trucks that are used to transport crashed cars from San Diego into Tijuana, and to use them as the infrastructure that would receive this house. And at the end of the project, at the end of the biennial, the house then would be transferred into Tijuana and given to some of these informal communities. The idea was also that we would appropriate a parking lot in San Diego to sort of encroach into these sort of vacant sites that really permeate the city and create a kind of environment that would address the issues of the information center, but also would send a message again to the city that it is these leftover spaces that we have a lot of potential if we were to reconceptualize them as sites for temporal programs. So we appropriated, this is when they are transporting the trucks into the parking lot, we appropriated maybe the most sacred parking lot in San Diego. You have to understand that for Californians, parking lots are sacred, right? So the idea that we would encroach into this parking lot across from the San Diego Museum of Art in the middle of this sort of theme park, kind of actually very beautiful park in San Diego, and create this temporal kind of public space, let's say, that would be just offered to people for just leisure, to waste time, but also to really share information about these dynamics. You know, the idea that this was a kind of context provider, in a way, to the exchange of information. As we built, of course, this piece that was pretty much a truck with a tent, you know, we actually generated with the budget of the art project this house. While the truck itself became just a loose scaffold that would really address the pragmatics of the information center, again, the excuse was that the building of this house will be, the message. The project is going to end, in fact, next week, and the dismantling of this house will begin so that it can be transferred to Tijuana and lost in that in sort of the dynamics of that city. And so finally, this sort of set of issues, of course, as we are back again to interested in this potential or that we find in the temporalization, let's say, of space, temporal dynamics that really transform our very notions of housing primarily, of city and the territory. It's interesting again to go back to the border and to notice this sort of journey from solid to light and from light to solid that we have been witnessing, let's say, recently in our discourse. So when we begin to notice that as the border of Tijuana San Diego has really hardened, again, from the kind of lightness, generally speaking, of the landscape into the solidity of this wall, our discourse, let's say, our dreams of architecture and urbanism have gone the opposite way from, again, the solid project, the kind of brutalist projects of the 70s, approximately, the institutional kind of project, the solidity of this project into the lightness, seeming lightness of contemporary, seemingly neo-avant-garde sort of positions at our moment when architects are, again, once more seduced by the notion of porosity, flexibility, open-endedness. In a way, this exposes not only the triviality at times of architecture in the context of these sociopolitical forces, but of course it suggests that if we begin continue to really be distant from those forces, these projects are as experimental as they might be, are reduced to becoming again a kind of a one-dimensional object, let's say, within this dynamic, within the city. Or maybe in the version of this other side of the of recent sort of neo-avant-garde positions, where architects are returning to the third world, right, to notice in some of these urban centers or urban conditions in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, the potential to redefine our very notions of urbanism and possibly enact this process or this project of layering, of complexity, of hybridity, of negotiating landscape, infrastructure, and inhabitation. I find it very doubtful that we could build this in London or that we could build this in New York or less in San Diego if we continue to perpetuate our cities again or our policies in terms of a project that continues to discriminate and that continues to really create this sort of social and economic inequalities. Or if we don't enter the actual particularity of the intensity of these patterns, let's say, that are occurring all over the world, the kind of social and cultural and political dimension of the territory. Or if these projects ultimately do not embrace or invent strategies, let's say, that would allow us to coexist ultimately with the contradictory, with again the ambiguous and the incongruous. It is in fact that sense of ambiguity and contradiction what has been erased in a sense of many of our institutions of representation in the relationship that architecture has to mass media at this very moment, when even the most radical projects of the avant-garde of the 60s and 70s in Italy and France have been reduced to this sort of same sort of homogeneous project, right? What is the ultimate impact of these new agendas as we begin to continue to ignore, again, these social and cultural problematics? Of course, it's a return, in a certain way, to the legacy that we've inherited, of course, from previous decades. But in a way, it's a very different agenda as we begin to notice how these projects in our time, again, this return to these aesthetics of the 70s, let's say, are emptied of their sociopolitical dimension. These notions of flexibility are really put into evidence that we live in a very different time. While in the 60s, I imagine, the kind of collective ethics, let's say, search for an emancipation of individual freedoms, right? In our time, I think, we are perpetuating this sort of issue of economic sort of private expansion of the individual. And what has happened is that that has completely compromised or produce a kind of collective apathy towards a social, again, the social and political project. Many of these projects in the observation, let's say, of these dynamics suggest that the role of architecture and urbanism would have to, again, embrace not only the particular kind of conditions of architecture, but really the larger, again, set of relationships across community, across these different patterns. Borrowing from a notion of relational aesthetics of Nicolas Bouriot that advanced this notion that form in art is an excuse to anticipate encounters and to invent new modes of sociability, architecture that would be embracing, again, interhuman relations. I would suggest that, again, it is a kind of transgression of this property line, this transgression of institutions and jurisdictions and agencies, so that we as architects also collaborate in creating new projects of collaboration, of alliance, let's say. These last two images I want to leave you with is to suggest that art, as usual, is sort of ahead of us in a way in terms of our field of architecture and urbanism. When Thomas Hirschhorn proposed this project to the Pompidou, when he was invited to be in an exhibition, and he asked the Pompidou if he could borrow three major pieces of art, including Duchamp's bicycle wheel and Warhol's electric chair, to bring those pieces outside the institution and bring them into a suburban a community beyond the periphery in Paris. The Pompidou, of course, you know, freaked out. This cannot happen because of insurance, etc. The artist proposed and created a whole project by which he convinced the insurance companies, by bringing a youth collaborative group from this suburb, this sort of North African suburb outside the borders, the city periphery of Paris, bringing them into Paris so that they could be trained in terms of curatorial practices and art handling. So he convinced insurance companies to finally agree, and the pieces were lent to the community. And this is when the community actually built what Thomas Hirschhorn called a precarious museum, right, to involve these sort of collaborations and this sort of choreography of resources. So it is this sort of a possibility of creating new modes or new processes of collaboration across community, across jurisdictions, and across institutions. And the ultimate, possibly, sort of transgression of these sort of institutional boundaries is this last image that actually was produced a couple of months ago at the border, again between Tijuana and San Diego, at the place that I showed you where the border sinks into the Pacific Ocean. Javier Tellez, a Venezuelan-born artist who lives in New York City, after working with mental patients from a psychiatric hospital in Mexicali, proposed with them to actually shoot a human cannonball from Tijuana into San Diego. And I was there you know, with the crowd, and it was an amazing moment when this cannon lifts up and Dave Smith, the most famous human cannonball, presented his passport to all the Mexicans, the US passport, and he was shot across the border. And as I was seeing this body arcing, you know, transgressing physically, ultimately, the border itself, it really made me think again that the ultimate, of course, border that we need to be transgressing, that we need to transgress, is that border that has perennially separated artistic experimentation from social responsibility. And ultimately, in this context, the kind of renegotiation of the utopian project and the very realities of the city. Thank you very much. I have one question. How long did I take?
A little more than the hour and five, but okay. Hour and ten.
All right.
Yes.
Hello? Okay. I have a question about the entire idea about integrating the NGO movement in coming up with more complexity. And I would be particularly interested how you see that in relation to local democracy. Since I don't know about the structure of these NGOs, how they are kind of built up, and how you can then ensure that decisions that are being taken are still kind of the majority will of the community. I think that complexity to a certain extent is, of course, much more problematic when it comes to conflicts of different interests. So the kind of monolithic structure, I guess, is a result of a democratic process as well.
Yes. Well, many times I think of that when we are orchestrating some of these workshops, you know, and primarily actually when I am present in some of the city hall or city council meetings in San Diego, right, where our sense of democracy in a way, in the context of the US politics is really, has been watered down because it's really, on one hand, it's about what everyone can say, right, and everybody has to have a sort of a voice, let's say, but I meditate many times that it doesn't matter if you know you have access to really that political discourse if the information itself has been tarnished again or has been compromised by these very reductive definitions. So part of the issue, again, as I was mentioning, is that embracing, of course, the voice of the community, but by a renewed sort of critical exchange of dialogue. Of course, it's important that when we are doing these projects with the nonprofit, we include, of course, the community itself, the people who live in these neighborhoods. But it has been very interesting to actually see or witness that many times what these people wanted within the community is really a Costco, for example, you know, or ultimately they would see the architecture that would construct their community be made of these stylistic recipes, in fact, of Spanish colonial-looking buildings, etc. It has been very interesting to move from that conversation to these notions, again, of parcels, of the collaboration of owners, the kind of potential that exists by looking at the informal patterns. And even though you might, one might think that it is a kind of imposition of sorts into something that has already been set in their mind, it has completely redefined not only a sense of identity within the community, but also the participatory practices of the community itself when they realize that they have a political stake here. So in other words, it's a very difficult question, but it is framing this condition of the democracy, let's say loosely speaking, out of a process that is a lot more dynamic and more proactive, really, in allowing the community to be really the one that constructs these political propositions, as opposed to just, you know, asking of a kind of end result right at the end of the project or the process. Yes.
I have actually two questions. One is that what you have shown in your presentation, the scenes in Tijuana, I would easily also say those pictures we saw would be, these kind of the process of invasion or territorialization also takes place in many informal settlements in developing countries, in those countries, so-called non-integrated groups country, to take the Pentagon's terminology. I just wonder if these changes are taking places in such informal settlements, to what extent is the border area important? What is so important about the border conditions? Mm-hmm. And also my second question is, mm-hmm. suppose that it's important, but you have taken this Tijuana as an example, which you were saying there are like 50,000 people crossing the border to work in San Diego from Tijuana, which means that there are a lot of capital coming in from San Diego into Tijuana. And I was just wondering to what extent these changes you have shown in Tijuana owe to the innovation of the people there, and to what extent it owes to the money which was brought by these people working in San Diego.
Right. Well, your first question, in reality, I was not suggesting that this condition of the Tijuana-San Diego border is so unique, let's say. I hope that to suggest that by just noticing these dynamics in terms of my own practice, my own involvement, let's say, with this territory, we could also anticipate or comment on what is going on in the rest of the world. Of course, this informal urbanism occurs in every periphery of the third world, in a sense, and beyond. And even now in our very, very cities, let's say, in the United States and Europe. But by understanding, again, the dynamics and really encroaching into that condition, let's say, I am able to redefine or kind of inspire a process that could be, again, useful, let's say, to enter the politics of zoning, let's say, in San Diego. So learning from Tijuana has been, in a way, a very important issue for me. At the same time, it has opened up a conversation with other people, friends that I've made that are working in other places in the world, in India, particularly in some sectors of Africa. And of course, this is exactly what we need to share. In fact, a friend of mine was telling me the other day, we should construct a kind of event where we just exchange processes from south to south within the southern hemisphere, so that we could really possibly replicate those processes as many communities across the world are really fighting and are struggling to really construct their own kind of resources. So on one hand, of course, it's not site-specific again. It's really occurring everywhere else in the world. But at the same time, there are tonalities that make it very specific. In India, for example, some of these informal communities can be erased or kind of eroded or, you know, pushed out, vacated very, very easily, let's say, by military force. In Mexico, as I was mentioning, there is a law that protects them. Hopefully the only kind of legacy that remained in the Mexican Revolution of 1910 in the kind of agrarian, you know, land reform. So the kind of political implications of how to support the informal kind of sector for Mexico is very different from what would occur maybe in Korea or, you know, in India, etc. And then the second one had to do with, of course, this relationship between Tijuana and San Diego and the codependence economically. Of course, that's an issue that I want to get deeper into research. I want to really talk about this phenomena in more accurate terms, let's say, beyond the kind of very visceral and emotional relationship with this territory. For example, what is the revenue generated by Mexican families coming to San Diego every weekend? You know, when you go to any mall in San Diego, what you hear is Spanish, for example. In other words, San Diegans need to acknowledge that they really depend on the economic influx from Tijuana, while at the same time, what are the implications of San Diegans moving into Tijuana incrementally as real estate has really gotten very inaccessible for in San Diego, many people are beginning to move into Tijuana to live. So the kind of codependence of these two the cities in terms of economic sort of dynamics is a very important issue. After all, this border exists precisely because of that. You know, San Diego in its own terms wouldn't be that interesting. But in fact, Tijuana wouldn't as well. If I was interested, and I'm interested in informal urbanism, if that, I was interested in the slum city, probably I should move to Rio de Janeiro or Sao Paulo or even in the outskirts of Caracas. But what makes this territory incredibly unique is the approximation of these very different projects or these very different economic conditions from the, you know, the wealthiest county, the wealthiest state, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, next to the one of the poorest settlements, again, not only in Latin America, but in the world as well.
Anyone else? Any other questions?
Yes.
Oh, this. Sala.
Thank you very much for your lecture. From what I understood with the microloan strategy you presented, I can imagine how land property rights can be secured from it and also financing. And from what I understand, although I think you're empowering the community at the political level, when you look at the end product, i.e., you know, material empowerment, some of these individuals might say, well, we're still with the rubber tire wall here. So if you ask them a question in terms of materiality, you know, how do we compare the rubber tire wall as the project in Tijuana versus the row of houses which were 6 feet high but looked like the American model? What do you feel their answer would be? I think, you know, the projects are very good, the micro, you know, the micro loan project for political empowerment, but. Yeah. At the end of the day, you know, we make judgments on visual perceptions of spaces as well. And the rubber tire wall, I think, might not, you know, solve a lot of these people's desires or visions of development.
What you're trying to suggest is that, of course, we cannot romanticize or, in a way, think of this notion that these people ultimately want to live in the midst of those very precarious sort of patterns in Tijuana, for example. Is that what you're suggesting? That's a very important question, and it always repeats itself in, you know, when I show these images, because we, of course, risk to enter this sort of very fine line or kind of condition by which we continue to romanticize, let's say, the kind of precariousness again of these very poor settlements. What is interesting is that it's not to, first of all, is it the commitment to really enter those dynamics. Right, but with very, of course, open, flexible kind of attitude. Because the first thing as an architect that I would want is, maybe traditionally speaking, is to, as the planners in San Diego, they want to eradicate that and begin anew. Right, as you saw in the periphery of Tijuana, they're building all these huge sort of master plan communities. Instead of really entering the problematics of this informal city with an attitude, hopefully, that is, again, very much about a kind of layering of infrastructure. In other words, it's a temporal transitional project. It's not to say that this is always going to be full of tires or full of, you know, a sort of pallet racks that are in disarray, et cetera. But how do we think of an acupunctural kind of, okay, kind of a project of acupuncture so that we begin by inserting very small, and hopefully the message also that I wanted to share with you is that the project of the future, as according to me, is really about a small project. It's a small project. It's kind of additive, kind of micro project that begins to build up a kind of, again, infrastructure, of, again, flexibility, et cetera. But I think it's a transitional project. Once that those frames, hopefully, if we were, this is just a speculation, of course, but when those frames begin to hopefully harden a bit the precariousness, but without eliminating, again, the improvisational energies of these places, they will begin to shape something ultimately that is unexpected to us, but really a kind of alternative project for those people who, you know, who inhabit it. In other words, it is this issue of being open to the unexpected, right, that will present us with very different ideas about materiality, about spatial organization, etc. So it's really about this initial catalytic sort of layer that will offer sites, other sites for intervention that are, at least for me, uncontrollable. This is in Tijuana, of course, but in San Diego, is the emphasis has been on actually providing services to these issues, these projects of housing, as small as they might be. So it's really about that kind of level of ambiguity as well, but with a different kind of scale. So in terms of systems or materiality, it's really about not thinking of the artifact, possibly, but really thinking of, again, this notion of site, right, as a kind of stage for, again, unexpected uses.
Well, I think I'm going to have to put an end to this. You have a comment?
Yes.
I just want to thank you very much. And I must say that I was somewhat skeptical about having two conferences, but the way this has developed in a year is extraordinary. And I want to also state that you can see the next proposal for the next prize on the CCA's website, which is cca.qc.ca.
That's for the next James Sterling Memorial Lecture. I can say that the first James Sterling Memorial Lecture on the city has been a spectacular success, and I thank you all for coming.
Thank you.